Okay. Alors, bienvenue tout le monde. Welcome, everybody. I'm glad to see what is, in my view, a fantastic turnout considering what's going on outside, not to mention that there's another award ceremony going on simultaneously, which is where I just was a few minutes ago. So it's great to be in a faculty that has so much to celebrate that it can afford to have two award ceremonies in parallel. This award ceremony is particularly exciting for me because it celebrates a number of aspects of the faculty that traditionally did not get celebrated. And so it follows on, convocation, student awards, and so on. But we have a bunch of special awards today. We have the Maud Abbott Award, the Hailey DeBass Award, and the Rosemary Wedderburn Brown Prize winners who will be coming up here and saying a few words in a few minutes. So first of all, let me express my excitement and my congratulations to those winners. So we have Julie Saint-Pierre from the Goodman Cancer Research Center, Loidy Jerome Majuska from Pediatrics, Sylvie Lambert from the Ingram School of Nursing, and we have a late arrival of last year's winner of the Brown Prize, Aparna Natig, the 2013 laureate, who's from the School of Communication Sciences and Disorders. And they're each going to come up here in a minute or two, successively. We're going to start in a minute or two to say a few words in regard to the prize they have gotten. I got to tell you that this kind of award ceremony is one of my favorite things, if nothing else, because there's always babies here, and I get to at least make faces at the babies. Anyway, without delay, I'm going to ask Julie Saint-Pierre to come up here. Julie is at the Goodman Cancer Research Center, and she's going to get the Maud Abbott Prize. Some of you may know Maud Abbott is not just a prize, and she's not just a museum, and she's not just a caricature in the faculty club, but she was actually an enormously important female faculty member that this university chose to not see fit to admit to its medical school class. So you see there were controversies about admissions even in the 19th century. And she went to Bishop's University Medical School, which doesn't exist anymore, and was a graduate there, but came here to work and became a world-renowned expert on congenital heart disease and published a definitive work in that area. And so we've chosen the Maud Abbott Prize to recognize outstanding female faculty members who excel in education, research, or administration, particularly with a focus on people early in their career, to celebrate Maud Abbott as one of Canada's earliest medical graduates and truly a great scientific leader. So in that regard, Julie is being recognized for her outstanding research, which she's going to tell us about right now. I have to give you the prize. Here you go. Congratulations.
All right.
Okay, I'll take the prize away now.
Okay. That's good. All right, is it this one? All right, yeah. Do you mean to move? Yeah, can we move the slides? All right. All right, so I'm truly honored to be receiving the Maud Abbott Prize today. So, as Dr. Edelman mentioned, my research laboratory is located at the Goodman Cancer Research Center, where I'm part of a team of scientists dedicated to better understand the link between cancer and metabolism. So my main interest in research has always been the mitochondria. So the mitochondria are the energy factory of the cell, and they play a fundamental role in biological processes. And given that they are so important, it's perhaps not surprising that alteration in mitochondrial metabolism is seen in numerous pathological conditions, like obesity, neurological disorders, and cancer. So since starting my research program at McGill University, I have been interested in understanding how metabolism is altered during tumorigenesis, in particular, how mitochondrial metabolism is modified. So everybody knows that cancer cells grow extensively and they grow very fast. So in order to fuel that high proliferation, cancer cells take over metabolic pathways to support their high energy needs. So if we look at it in a timeline, We can see we start with a normal cell here that is basically metabolically quiescent. So what does this mean? It has basal nutrient uptake, minimal biosynthesis, and no net growth. And then a mutation occurs. It could be oncogene activation, tumor suppressor inactivation, and then this results in a transformed cell. But in the field of cancer metabolism, what we often say is that this transformed cell also undergoes a metabolic transformation. That is, metabolic pathways are rewired to support the high proliferation capacities of these cells. So often what we could see is high nutrient uptake, high glycolytic rate, increased biosynthesis, and then net growth. So the most famous metabolic alteration that is seen in cancer is called the Warburg effect. So as I mentioned in my first slide, most cells use mitochondria to make energy. But tumors, often what they do is they don't use so much their mitochondria to make energy, but they use this alternative metabolic pathway to generate energy that's called aerobic glycolysis. But this pathway is much less efficient at producing energy than the mitochondria. So to compensate for this inefficiency, tumor cells take up a lot of glucose. And this property of cancer cell is actually used in the clinic, where you can use an analog of glucose that's called fluorodeoxyglucose. And then when it's injected in the patient, you can actually visualize tumors. So they're all illustrated in black here. So this high capacity for cancer cell to take up glucose is the reason why we often say that cancer cells are addicted to glucose. All right, so the main objective of my research program is to understand and integrate how metabolism influences the initiation, progression, metastasis, and development of therapeutic resistance in cancer, with the aim of identifying potential targets that could be used for therapeutic purposes. All right, so in order to study cancer metabolism, we're very fortunate at the Goodman Cancer Research Center because we have access to a metabolomics core facility where we can perform a sophisticated metabolic analysis. In fact, in parallel to starting my research lab at the Goodman Cancer Research Center and Department of Biochemistry, I took over the scientific direction of the metabolomics core facility. So in the core, we have highly skilled scientists, and also the facility is equipped with state-of-the-art equipment. So this is just a picture of the facility. And this is just to highlight that we have numerous equipment to do various metabolic assays. So we have this machine called the Seahorse, where we can measure respiration. I'm not going to go into detail, but we have various mass spectrometer. And then with these, we can assay metabolism in a very precise manner. So I'm just giving you an example here of, you know, the metabolomics core capabilities. So, for example, we could take, let's say, a control cell and a cancer cell, and then what we could do is we can measure the concentration of various metabolites. So we call that metabolite profiling. So we take, different condition, or it could even be like a cancer cell versus a cancer cell that has been exposed to a therapeutic drug. And then we look at the metabolite concentration between those two conditions. Another type of analysis that we do, it's called CETA, or stable azotope tracer analysis. So very simply what it is that we can label nutrient, and then we put that onto cell, and then we look how these nutrients travel through the various metabolic pathways inside cell. So in the interest of time, I'm just going to highlight and show our most recent discovery in cancer metabolism that was made possible through the capabilities of the metabolomics core facility. So our most recent project was on metformin. So metformin is the most commonly prescribed drug for the treatment of type 2 diabetes. And epidemiological studies have shown that users of metformin show decreased cancer risk. So for this reason, metformin is currently being investigated in clinical trials for its role in cancer prevention and treatment. And this is just to show like how the interest in metformin and cancer has grown over the years. So if we look at by the year 2000, 11% of the scientific paper were on metformin and cancer. And by 2014, this percentage has actually doubled, where you have about 20% of the papers on metformin that are related to cancer. And despite its common use, the molecular target of metformin is incompletely described. So it's been thought that the target of metformin could be in the mitochondria. There was some indication it could be complex one. But other target, like notably some located in the cytoplasm, were also mentioned. So what we did, I'm not going to go through the detail of these data, but it's just to show what we did is we did some experiment in cells here. And then on the right, what we did is we actually isolated the mitochondria from these cells. And then we exposed the cells or the mitochondria to metformin, and we look at their metabolite profile. And then what we could see actually was that the metabolite profile of the cell and the mitochondria were actually very similar. So this told us that you can actually remove mitochondria from the cell, take them in isolation, and then if you expose them to metformin, you can actually modify metabolism. And that signature was also present at the cellular level. So we could conclude that metformin was acting directly on the mitochondria. So if you look at these metabolites here, for example, they were decreased at the mitochondrial level, and they were also decreased here at the cellular level. We also did some, you know, respiration experiment and other assays, and in the end, we could come up with a model where we showed that metformin in cancer cell entered the cell, and it actually targets the mitochondria, precisely it was complex 1, and this limited the ability of the mitochondria to produce energy. So then cells were forced to rely on this alternative pathway that I've mentioned at the beginning, called glycolysis. But because this pathway is absolutely dependent on glucose, if you actually take cancer cell and you expose them to metformin and you remove glucose, you greatly affect cell viability. So it was great using the core. We could use these two systems in parallel, intact cells and isolated mitochondria, and we could show how this drug was working. So this is the last slide, the most important slide. So these are the acknowledgments. So these are highly qualified trainees I'm very privileged to work with every day in the lab. So I have Sean McQuirk, David Papadopoulos, Sylvie Andreski, Simon-Pierre Gravel, Valérie Chénard, and Elizabeth Kovacs. I also wish to highlight a key PI in the Department of Biochemistry and the Goodman Cancer Center that greatly helped me when I started my research program here at McGill. These are Vincent Giguère, Nicole Beauchemin, Michel Tremblay, David Thomas, Peter Siegel, John Silvius, Albert Burgais, and last but not least, Dr. Morag Park. And of course, I also want to thank the scientists working in the Metabolomics Core facility, Gaël Bridon, Orval Mamard, Dana Visonis, and Luc Chanière, as well as the funding agencies that are supporting my research.
Very cool. Are there any questions?
Oh, sorry.
I actually have one. Sorry. What are the next steps in this research?
Well, now we have identified, like, we were working, like, I did not enter the details here, but we were working with breast cancer cells, so we'd like to see basically how efficacious can be metformin for other cancer types. So we're now looking to go into looking at prostate cancer because it's very different metabolically from other cancers.
So I have a question, which is, if this is working, if the pathway you've proposed is correct, is this a class-specific effect, or is it, you're going to be able to make targets that are more specific for complex one? Or?
Yeah, I mean, there's different like drugs in the family, like fenformin and metformin. That we haven't tested if fenformin is working like metformin. Mm-hmm. But I think in terms of, like, the biggest challenge would be to identify within complex one which subunit, because the complex one is really big, it has about 40 subunits, it would be to identify precisely which one. And then for pharmacokinetic studies, it's going to be very important. Okay. So we need crystal structure people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you think that this will be oncogene specific? So I guess what I'm asking is, depending on what the mutation is in the cancer cell, will you get a different profile and different response from metformin?
Use the mic.
I would say yes. I would say that because some cancer cells are, for example, I've shown like the Warburg type, right? They're highly glycolytic. They don't use their mitochondria. But for example, if you take prostate cancer, it's very different. It's heavily dependent on mitochondrial metabolism. Oncocytomas are like that. So I think at baseline, if you're more dependent, you might be even more susceptible to metformin. That would be my prediction. But of course, much research is needed to do and to show that.
There are no other questions. I want to thank you very much and congratulate you again on this fantastic work. All right. So that was great. And now it says, pause, quick photo. Did we take a photo? He's taking them. Okay. So next, I have the privilege of inviting Lloydie Jerome Mahuska to come up. She's from the Department of Pediatrics, and she will be receiving the Haile T. DeBose Prize. I like a prize where I actually have met the person after whom the prize is named. So this prize recognizes a faculty member who helps to promote diversity by acting as a role model or mentor, or implementing new approaches to address underrepresented minorities. Now, why is it called the Haile DeBose Prize? So some of you will know that Haile DeBose was the, among other things, was the big boss at UCSF during its recent extraordinary growth phase, and really had made an extraordinary contribution to making what was already an excellent a medical school into an even more excellent medical school, arguably one of the most excellent medical schools. But he started out, he's in the famous class of 1963, which I had the privilege of going to the 50th anniversary celebration last year and then having to leave early because they stayed up too late for me. This is an amazing class full of extraordinary achievers, but one of them is Haile DeBose, a person who came to Canada to medical school here at a time when we were able to take more international medical students from Ethiopia, and was the only, probably the only minority person in the class of almost any kind of minority you can imagine, and went on to an extraordinarily distinguished career, having finished medical school here, going to UBC, and then eventually ending up in California, where he ended up one of the leading medical academics of the world. And in part of his achievement was to establish global health as an important topic for medical schools. And we had the privilege of having him back here last year. But we feel it's very appropriate as part of our diversity efforts, but just also because it's the right thing to do, to celebrate Dr. DeBose by having this award. So now I get the privilege of inviting Lloydie up to receive her plastic thingy. Oh, put it up. What am I doing? Okay. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And now I take it away from you. Well, we'll give it back later.
It's all yours.
So first of all, I'd like to say thank you very much to everybody that's here, including my family and my students from the lab and members of the faculty. That's been really awesome in helping me to establish here. I actually Googled Haile T. DeBose when this came out because I wanted to know more about him. And one of my favorite quotes from him was that he said one of the things that drove him in his research was that he was never afraid to take a chance. And so I think that's a great way to approach science and life in general. So now I will tell you a little bit about my work. So the title of my talk is Genetic and Cellular Basis of Morphogenesis. I'm a developmental biologist. And what I'm interested in is how tissue is shaped, organs are formed. So what I'm showing you here is an example of the model system we use in my lab. These are mouse embryos, and what you can see is that, first of all, there's an enormous amount of growth that takes place over development. So this is at embryonic day 9, and this is only 3 days later. And what you can see is that a lot of structures that are present in this very early stage embryo becomes remodeled over time to form, for example, a recognizable face, or to form a recognizable limb that's going to be patterned to give you the normal digits. And this process, which happens in utero during development, is quite critical. Because if it goes wrong, it's often why you have congenital malformations in newborns. And so congenital malformations are single or multiple defects of morphogenesis that are identified at birth or in utero during development. There's a 2-3% incidence worldwide, and there is evidence for contribution from both environmental and genetic factors. And I'll tell you right away that in my lab, we're very focused on the genetic factors, although we think that nutrients and other factors are also contributing to this. So how do you identify the genes that are responsible for normal morphogenesis and then look to see why their mutations give you abnormalities? Well, we use two different systems. So we use both forward genetic screens as well as reverse genetic screens. And so to identify genes that are required for normal morphological development, it makes sense to take someone, a baby or a mouse that's morphologically abnormal, and look to see what's mutated. And so we do that, and that's what the forward genetic screen does. And so me specifically, I'm very interested in cranial abnormalities. And so with collaboration both at the Genome Center with Dr. Majewski and with collaborators at Children's Hospital in CHOP in Philadelphia, we get samples from patients with craniofacial abnormalities, and we use next-generation sequencing to identify genes that are mutated. Another very powerful tool is reverse genetics. And so to do this, what you do is you look for a gene of interest, and then you make mutation in that gene to see if it gives you a craniofacial abnormality. And I'll show you examples of both things. So this just summarizes what we've done in the past 5 years. And so we've identified mutations in a gene called SNAP29, which is actually a snare protein, and shown that it contributes to abnormalities in a well-described and well-known syndrome called DeGeorge syndrome, or 22q11 deletion syndrome. We've also found that mutations in multiple genes can change the phenotype that you see when single genes are mutated. And this is work that is still underway. And so what we're trying to understand is how mutations in SEC23A, which is a code protein involved for transport of proteins, interact with mutation with MEN1B1, a mannositase that's important for recognizing misfolded protein, give you a completely different syndromes than mutations of these two genes independently. Most of our work and the work that started in my lab actually is with a mouse mutant that we identified in a four genetic screen, where we found these mutants that are very abnormal, and we went ahead and mapped the gene and shown that it was mutated in this gene called TIMED2, and I'll tell you a little bit more about this gene. So this is what started my work, and so what you see here are examples of normal development on the left side, both of embryos as well as placentas, and what happens when things go awry. And so I'll start with the embryo here. What you can see right away is that these two embryos are quite different. And so this one is small. Many of the structures that should develop aren't developed properly. And these embryos, although we find them, a few of them at embryonic day 11.5, will all die at this stage. But what actually kills them is that they don't form a normal placenta. So I don't have to tell anybody in this room that, although not well studied, the placenta is the most important organ. Without it, we wouldn't be here. And so what we showed was that under normal circumstances, two tissues interact to form a labyrinth layer where you have positioning of embryonic blood vessels next to maternal sinuses for efficient transport of nutrients between the embryo proper and the maternal environment. In the homozygous mutant embryos, we fail to form this structure. And so there's no nutrition, the embryos are going to die. But when we look at our work, both in the mouse system as well as in human patients, what's emerging is that there's a very important role or cell type specific requirement for proteins involved in vesicular transport during embryogenesis. So this is just to show you how vesicular transport takes place. So you have proteins that are generated here in the ER membrane that are going to be transported intragradially through the Golgi for proper modification and out to the plasma membrane for their proper function. And so what we have found is that at least three different mutations give you very specific morphological defects during embryogenesis. But when we started this work, if you were to ask anybody, these proteins should all be required in every single cell. And so what we think we've found, and actually to date many more people now are showing this, is that during embryogenesis, things are different. And so we've gone ahead and looked at expression of some of these genes, and they're not expressed in every cell. So during the process of development, you have very specific requirements for transport of proteins, and different members of subfamilies are interacting in different ways for these transport to happen. So just very quickly, I said I would show you an example of reverse genetic. And so this is work that started with a postdoc in my lab where we were looking at alternative splicing. Again, an event that happens in every single cell. And what we found was that one of these alternative splicing factors was quite specifically expressed in this region here that's called the pharyngeal arches. So the expression is in purple, and that's what I'm showing you here. So this will be remodeled to give rise to the face, the nose, the eyes, etc. So this is the eyes forming here. And this gene is actually one of the common deleted genes in a region of chromosome 8q21. And patients with this deletion have very specific craniofacial malformations. And so what we're doing now is using forgenetic to generate mutation in this gene to see if we can phenocopy some of the phenotype of these patients and to figure out what its contribution is to this syndrome. So to summarize, we use forward and reverse genetics to facilitate the identification of genes that are required for normal morphogenesis, but it's not sufficient to just know what these genes are. And so the hard part is actually trying to figure out what these genes are doing. And so we've decided to focus our work on the role of vesicular transport, and specifically retrograde transport, and alternative splicing during morphogenesis. A long time ago, I used to be in the lab, but I actually don't do much anymore. And so I have to thank the members of my lab, Dominic Howe, Swati Gupta, Libin Yun, Ahmad Elaban, and Vafa Kisar, who are continuing the work to date. I've had some really amazing students here at McGill, and I've had interaction with some really amazing faculty. Some of them are here, and I could name a few. So David, Rima, and John have been really key to my progression as a scientist here, and so I'd like to thank them for coming, and thank you for your time.
Well, that very cool talk is open for questions. So I will ask a question about the, oh, thank you. Usually I don't need, I have a very loud voice. I want to ask a question in terms of, it seems that the genetic mutations are so specific to the phenotype, it's surprising to a complete neophyte like me that, yeah, that you get such a characteristic phenotypic change from such a relatively small change in genetic expression, or protein expression, like one mutation, and suddenly you get this enormous phenotypic change. And it raises the question for me in terms of, even epigenetic changes that might happen, since I deal with old people, in later in life, right? How limited a change in gene function could result in such a dramatic change. Is that because you're dealing with developmental tissues, or is that because you're dealing with a set of a sequence of events which is very dependent on a certain number of sort of choke points?
So I think it depends on when the mutation happens and the type of mutation that you have. And so you do see a huge phenotype with small changes, for example, in cancer, right? So you can have oncogenic mutations that shouldn't really change very much, but can give you cancer. So I think these genes, the reason why during development you get such a huge phenotype is that at that time you have many different fields that have been established. And so these genes are expressed in multiple tissues that have to communicate to actually form the proper organ. And so when you have one system where you have communication required and one side is talking but the other side can't hear, things go awry. And so cells can't move to the right place, they can't express the right receptors, so they can't see their neighbors and they don't know where they are. So then they die. And so that's probably why you have such huge effects.
So it's like network behavior that's breaking down.
Yep, essentially.
Well, very cool. Okay. You have a critic in the back. Any other questions? If not, I'm going to thank you very much, lady, for that excellent talk. Okay. Okay, well, I'll do it from here. Right now, it's my pleasure to ask Sylvie Lambert, who is from the Ingram School of Nursing, to accept the Rosemary Wedderburn Brown Prize. And this prize has been specifically chosen to recognize faculty from the Schools of Communication Sciences and Disorders, School of Nursing, and School of Physical and Occupational Therapy, with outstanding scholarly potential and or demonstrated research excellence in the early stages of their career. So this is named after Rosemary Wedderburn Brown, who is also a McGill alumnus. And for those who know their Canadian history, was a renowned advocate dedicated to equality and rights for women, minorities, and disadvantage. She also served as an extraordinary role model by being the first woman of color in a provincial legislature. So in that case, it's my pleasure to ask Sylvie Lambert to come up and accept this prize. Thank you. We've got to take a picture. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here this evening and have the opportunity to present some of my research, particularly in the cancer caregiving area. Before I go any further, I would like to thank Dr. Helen Easer, the director at the School of Nursing, for supporting my nomination for this prize. A major part of the credit also goes to Dr. Carmen Loisel, my PhD supervisor and now mentor, as well as Professor Afa Gergis, my postdoctoral supervisor. I'm originally from McGill. I obtained my bachelor's in 2000 from the School of Nursing and then my PhD in 2008. Shortly thereafter, I moved to beautiful Australia to take up a two-year postdoc position with the University of Newcastle. And then as a National Health and Medical Research Council Fellow, I joined the University of New South Wales in Sydney for an additional 3 years. I've been back a year, but I guess that's a bit of a denial, especially with today's weather, at the School of Nursing. My program of work is in psychosocial oncology, and the specific projects that are part of this program of work focus on examining the impact of cancer on patients and their partners and caregivers, as well as developing and evaluating self-care and illness self-management interventions, really to help patients, their partners, their caregivers, to be able to develop the skills and abilities that they need to confront cancer challenges in a way that we hope will optimize their health and functioning. Also, a few of my studies focus on examining the methods or evaluating the methods that we use in psychosocial oncology. So for the next 6 to 7 minutes, I'll be focusing on two of my foundational studies that I conducted in Australia and really are at the core of my program of work now that I'm back in Canada. The first one in green is a longitudinal caregiver, partner and caregiver well-being study, and the other one is the Coping Together intervention, which is a self-directed coping skill intervention for patients and their partners. So why such a big focus on partners and caregivers, patients, partners, and caregivers in my program of work? Well, we know that they've always played a major role in patients' cancer care. However, their level of involvement in complex management tasks is steadily increasing and really at a level that's been unprecedented. And this has been attributed to an increased reliance on outpatient treatments, as well as shortage of healthcare professionals and decreased financial resources. We know that their involvement reduces demands on the healthcare system. That's documented. We also know that they have a very positive impact on patients' adjustment and health outcomes. However, this does come at a particularly high cost for them. They often report a high burden. So with this realization that we have a growing cohort of partners and caregivers, they're more and more involved, but this also seems to impact negatively on them. There has been a marked increase in the research to really better understand what are the ripple effects of a diagnosis and treatment on them. So our team has recently concluded Australia's first longitudinal study on partners and caregivers of patients diagnosed with cancer. This is only second in size to the one conducted by the American Cancer Society. There has been no comparable studies yet in Canada. And we aim to describe changes in anxiety, depression, quality of life, and unmet needs over the first 5 years post-patient diagnosis and identify some of the variables associated with these outcomes to answer the key question, who are those caregivers that are most at risk of illness maladjustment? Who as healthcare professionals, key stakeholders, should we be targeting? So participants were sent a comprehensive survey at 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 3.5 and 5 years post-patient diagnosis. And so for the next three slides, I thought I would highlight four key findings pertaining to anxiety across the first three data collection time points. So my first key finding that I wanted to share with you today is that the prevalence of anxiety among partners and caregivers significantly decreased over time. It exceeded population norm, but it still decreased over time. So that's the good news. The second key finding, not so good news, is that at each data collection time point, the prevalence of anxiety among partners and caregivers significantly exceeded the rates reported by the patients. So the difference between the blue and the red bar. Our third analysis focused on identifying differential patterns of change over time. What do I mean by that? Well, we know from the previous slide that as a group, partners and caregivers' anxiety goes down. But it is possible that within this group, there are subgroups of partners and caregivers that have an increase in anxiety over time. Others might experience a chronic level of anxiety over time. And so we conducted trajectory analysis using the SAS procedure proctrage to identify, to tease out what are those different subgroups. And what we found is really there are two major subgroups of partners and caregivers. 50% of do just fine. They're not anxious at the beginning, 2 years post-patient diagnosis, they're still not anxious. However, about 50% experience chronic levels of anxiety. And we found similar findings for depression. And those that reported chronic anxiety also reported chronic depression. So we're very concerned about this subgroup, and it's almost 50%. This led us to conclude that distressed partners and caregivers do not recover easily. My fourth and last key finding related to this study is that when we looked at what are the predictors of being in that group of chronic anxiety, these are the ones where we want to focus on and provide intervention and services that can address these risk factors. And we found that the most prominent predictor was not having the coping skills, not having the self-care abilities to be able to confront cancer challenges on a daily basis. And so to address this risk factor directly, our team then developed the Coping Together intervention. Coping Together is a self-directed coping skills intervention for patients and their partners. This intervention really focuses on providing practical information. There's a lot of resources out there about what is cancer and what is treatment, but not a lot of resources about how, when you wake up at 4 a.m., when you're anxious and you don't know what to do, how do you deal with some of these cancer challenges on a daily basis, whether it's be taking your decision about treatment, whether it's about getting the support you need, supporting each other as a dyad, how do you do these things? And there's a lot of research that has been done that supports very evidence-based strategies. So we translated that research and made it readily available to patients and their partners so that they could hopefully use it on a daily basis. We wanted it to be accessible, so we used booklets, DVD, the web, and a CD. So we concluded two studies in Australia at this point in time on coping together. One is a qualitative feasibility study. We simply wanted to first and foremost answer the question, will patients and partners use this intervention on a daily basis at a time when they actually are under a lot of stress, they already receive a lot of information, are we actually giving them too much information? And actually, the overall answer was that, yes, patients and partners wanted this kind of information. It definitely filled a gap in terms of the type of information that they were receiving. The self-directed format was a particular strength of our intervention. Many partners and caregivers said, I don't have time to go to support groups. I know they're out there. I just don't have time. But I was able to use your booklet in the train while going to work. So that was great. The fact that we're focusing on very practical information and the fact that we didn't just put out another resource that just targeted the patient but targets the patient partner dyad. This is really the foundational support system during this time. And also we were encouraged by the fact that our intervention seemed to facilitate independent coping and self-care. Another study that was just concluded just before I left Australia was a pilot with men with prostate cancer and their wives. The plus signs in this table indicate trends and efficacy. It is a pilot, so I'm talking about trends and efficacy in favor of coping together. And as expected, our partners seem to benefit more from the intervention than patients. In Australia right now, I still have an ongoing multi-center trial. We have 20 centers involved in this trial to further examine the efficacy of this intervention as well as its cost effectiveness. So hopefully in a year, we'll be able to go to cancer organizations and centers and say, this is an intervention that we know works. It works in a cost-effective manner and hopefully easily integrated into practice given its self-directed nature. Well, that's the hope. I do have a very large team behind me, and without them, I wouldn't have been able to progress in this program of work and now implement this in Canada. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yes. We have a question.
The level of anxiety in the caregivers and the partners have an impact on the survival rate of the patients?
Yes, that is a good question. That's not something we've been looking at this point in time, and there are no studies at this point in time documenting that, but that's a good question.
Well, I have a question, unsurprisingly.
My question has to do with the generalizability of these findings, because there are other severe chronic diseases other than cancer in which the interaction with the caregiver is very important. I'm thinking of obviously of pediatric diseases, but also mental illness, which has especially chronic mental illness in a family, as well as people who have to be caregivers for someone with something like COPD or bad heart failure. So can you comment on that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good comment. Some of the self-care skills and coping strategies are really at the core of any caregiving relationship, and I've been talking to some other organization in some of the fields that you've mentioned, and there's definitely some applicability, so definitely high generalizability. Not necessarily, we don't know in terms of the efficacy in these other groups, but definitely in terms of the content.
That's great.
Diana has a question.
In Australia, were the outcomes similar?
Yeah, very similar, very similar. With the exception of some of the financial concerns, because Australia is very more similar to Canada in terms of the coverage, the healthcare coverage. So, but in terms of the anxiety, the depression, the unmet needs, definitely comparable. Yep.
Okay, thank you very much. That was great. Well, this year we have stereo, so we can, it's just like we're really there. This year we celebrate a second Rosemary Wedderburn Brown Prize, but it's last year's winner, who couldn't join us last year for, she was busy being productive and expanding her family, so she's here with her family tonight. So I'd like to invite Aparna Natig from the School of Communication Sciences and Disorders to come up and accept her award.
I got it.
Okay, we gotta take a picture. Congratulations.
Is there a pointer? Okay, so I'd like to thank the Faculty of Medicine for this honor and also my colleagues in the School of Communication Sciences and Disorders for nominating me for this award. And I'd like to thank all of you for letting me present this a year late. So last June I had a baby and probably would have been a very different type of presentation, although she seems to be making herself known. Okay. So, all of you hear about autism often in the popular press, and given the most recent prevalence estimates that 1 in 68 children has an autism spectrum disorder, I imagine many of you know someone who's personally affected by autism as well. Today I'm going to speak to you about two lines of my research that focus on understanding language development and facilitating communication in people with autism spectrum disorders. So let's start with what we know. Language is key in ASD. So first of all, language is a key area of core difficulty. So for example, in preschool children with ASD, they're significantly delayed in vocabulary development. And this type of difficulty with language and communication is evidenced in different ways, completely across the autism spectrum, at different levels of functioning and at different ages, but it remains there. It's a shared core difficulty. We also know that nonverbal IQ and early social communication skills, so pre-verbal skills like gesturing and pointing to objects of interest, are strong predictors of concurrent and long-term language outcomes. And this predictive power holds over the lifespan. So for example, school-age language predicts adult outcomes. Essentially, the idea here is that the more language you have, the more you can learn. The better you do in your home environment and your ability to communicate with others,
in terms of social integration, in terms of academic performance and professional outcomes if they're relevant to the case. Okay. However, there's enormous variability in language development in ASD, and we don't really know why. So we have young children with ASD as a group being delayed in their vocabulary development, yet there's also other children who perform at age level and who don't have these kinds of delays. So what I've been focused on in this first project I'm going to talk to you about is trying to understand, to identify factors that are related to ideal outcomes in order to be able to use them in interventions for language in ASD. So in my group, we've been looking at both parental factors and child factors that are known to impact child language development. So we know that in the typical case, a range of parent factors play a role in language development. So for example, how we label objects and using nonverbal cues for children in free play, how we modulate the melody of our voice and exaggerate it and articulate it in speaking to children as opposed to adults, and simply the input that we provide, the speech that's produced in interactions with children. So this serves as a rich store of information for them to use to develop their language. So it's possible that some of the language delay that we see in ASD could come from differences in this environment that's available to children. And that's because this environment is dyadic in nature. So the more I interact with you, the more you're going to interact back with me. Right? So given that children with ASD have characteristic deficits in social interaction, it's possible that what kids have to work with is simply different, that what they have going in is different. So however, when we compare parents of children with ASD and parents of children without ASD, where the children have similar language levels, we find many similarities. So they're very similar in their in their labeling behaviors. So they use the same types of gestures, the same types of labeling strategies and introducing new objects to their children. And they also, in both groups, adapt their communication to the child's language level. So parents of children with ASD are very sensitive to where they're at and what kind of information they need to understand a communicative bid. We also found that parents in both groups are similarly modify the acoustics of their speech, so the melody of their speech, in exaggerating it more when speaking with their children than with an adult. And we found that they provide very similar types and amount of input when we look at a range of linguistic measures. I'll come back to this in a moment. Okay, we've also been examining a number of child factors that impact vocabulary learning. So remember here that we're comparing children with and without ASD who have similar language levels, meaning that the children with ASD are older, by definition, because of their language delays. So in this sample, we found that both groups of children were similarly able to make use of social cues to learn a new label. So what I mean here is that in a situation like this where a parent is playing with a child, let's say the woman looks at the duck, points to it, gazes at it, and says duck. The child, in being able to use social cues, is able to look away from what's perceptually salient to them towards the other object and learn that word duck, which has been applied to an object outside of their perceptual view at that time. And we've also found that children with ASD of similar language level are as good as or perhaps even better at retaining sounds of words. They make fewer errors they make fewer encoding errors of new novel words that they've heard. And in fact, the children with ASD in these studies have shown that they're similarly able to make implicit use of linguistic input. So in particular, we've found that linguistic input predicts child vocabulary 6 months later, similarly in both groups. So what I'm showing you here is that a range of maternal input, so this is the length and complexity of mother's sentences when they're in play with their child, At this range, you have more complex, longer speech, and this is related to higher vocabulary levels in their children 6 months later, above and beyond the child's initial language level, which we've controlled for in the analysis. Okay. This is a really crucial finding because you see that this relationship of increased parental input being related to higher vocabulary 6 months later is similar both in the children with autism and typically developing kids. This is a new finding for autism, and it shows crucially that the children are able to make use of the linguistic environment that's out there. So, what have we seen here about language learning and implications for intervention in ASD? Well, my team has shown that when matched on language ability, children with ASD show similar language learning processes as do typically developing children, but at a substantial age delay. We've also seen that parents provide children with ASD with a rich ambient linguistic environment that's adapted to their capabilities, and that, crucially, children with ASD are able to make use of this language environment to build their vocabulary. In terms of intervention, the findings support a recent trend in intervention in ASD, so parent-implemented interventions. And they also support strategies such as language expansion, so simply building on language that the child provides. The child says car, the parent or the educator says a bright blue car. And the findings support that parents and educators of children with ASD should be encouraged to provide their children with plentiful language interactions, which is the case for all children, but we're shown here that the kids with ASD also can make use of the input. Okay, I'm gonna switch now to completely different topic, still within autism spectrum disorders, but looking at adults. So you've probably heard a lot about children with ASD, as in what I've just been speaking to you about. There's been a really strong push for early identification of ASD, earlier and earlier interventions for ASD. But what's really, what's often overlooked in this is that all these children who are now being diagnosed with ASD are going to grow up to be adults, and there are very, very few services available for people beyond school age. So ASD is a lifespan diagnosis. Social difficulties remain throughout the lifespan into adulthood and affect opportunities in the workplace and the larger community. What is perhaps most tragic about this is that the people who have the highest abilities in terms of language and IQ and functioning are affected by this as well. So fewer than 5% of adults at the highest end of the spectrum were living independently, and only 12% were employed viably, although their capabilities are definitely beyond this level. So there are various services that exist for adults, especially for those who do not have intellectual disability. And high quality research on efficacy of interventions for adults with ASD is even more scarce. So to address this gap, along with my colleague and co-director, Tara Flanagan, in educational and counseling psychology, I developed the McGill Transition Support Program for adults with ASD. We've also been working with Keely White, who's a doctoral student and who's been a fantastic project manager and key facilitator for our groups. The project is funded by the Max Bell Foundation, and it involves curriculum pertaining to skills that enable adaptation and the ability to cope with transition in the long term. It's a small format group service for 18 to 30 year olds who are on the autism spectrum who do not have intellectual disability. It meets 2 hours a week for 10 weeks over the course of an academic term, and it's facilitated by graduate students in the School of Communications and Disorders and Educational and Counseling Psychology. So it's interprofessional in that sense. And a key point of this program that's quite different from other programs is that it's not predetermined in terms of what we've decided that the participants will need to work on. So they actually determine what they want to work on by completing a needs assessment at the beginning of the program, and the content is developed on a group-by-group basis in that fashion. So we're also running a randomized control trial on this intervention using a waiting list control group. It's being conducted over 4 terms, so we're in the midst of that. We started last summer, and it's continuing through winter 2015. The final sample will involve 28 participants, with 16 randomly assigned to intervention and 12 to a waiting list group, followed by participation in the intervention. So far, we have 23 participants enrolled, with 2 groups running this summer. They just started last week, in fact. And the participants are assessed pre and post either their intervention term or their waiting list term on a range of measures, including quality of life, social problem solving ability, interpersonal communication, reports of their needs and strengths, and parent reports of their level of functioning. So the data to date is very promising with respect to participant satisfaction and their self-report of change in key skill areas. And stay tuned for the results as we finalize the data from the RCT. And finally, I'd like to acknowledge my lab members, especially doctoral students Hanadi, Janet, and Anna Maria, as well as a fantastic team of research assistants and students and the agencies that support our work. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes.
I don't know if it was in one of your graph, but is there a particular age at which children with ASD are more responsive to these interaction you mentioned with the adult, like an age group?
Like a cutoff age? No, there's...
No, but let's say like you do it like, I don't know, 18 months, you know, you get the, let's say, the amelioration, like how the improve is better, like at that age versus like, I don't know, 5, 7 years old. Is it always the same improvement that you would see at different ages?
No, not necessarily. So the age difference that we had between our groups in the first study who had caught up and who are at a similar language level, on average it was about 2.5 years different, but there was extreme variability there. So there were some kids who were almost at age level with their language, and there were some kids who were delayed by 4 or 5 years. So I guess the variability is kind of the key, and it's hard to say to give a...
Thank you. When you're looking at the ASD kids, are you limiting yourself to those that that do not have a specific underlying diagnosis, Fragile X or something else?
Yes, we are. Yeah. In most studies, not in all, so not in the transition support program, for example. So there it's very broad inclusion. Yeah.
So I wanted to go back to your first study, and it seemed to me that the observation of the capacity of the ASD kids to pick up language, this is the way it seemed to me, almost indistinguishably from normal kids, mm-hmm. It contrasts with their ability to express language, which at least in my limited experience isn't always so clear.
Right.
So what does that tell you about the defect that is accounting for the phenotypic presentation of ASD?
So the difference between production and
reception
of language.
Well, I mean, it's a profound, it's a dramatically different thing. ASD kids don't sound like regular kids. They don't talk.
So you're talking about their, the tone of voice,
well,
right?
You're talking about language. They're absorbing language. They're learning language.
Right.
They're picking up the cues for language exactly as they're...
So they are at a significant delay. So I guess what the first study shows us is that most of them were substantially delayed at the age where they were performing the same on these language understanding tasks. What those studies show us is that they're able to use the same strategies and the same underlying processes. So they aren't doing it exactly the same at the same age. But I think what you're getting at is that their speech production is more noticeably different, perhaps. And that's actually, so comprehension in ASD is actually something that is a particular difficulty. So maybe that didn't come across in the way that I presented the data. But so it's not the case. It's actually in typical development, you have understanding that precedes production of language by a good extent. And in ASD, you actually have this distance diminished, right? So they may be speaking quite a bit and not understanding as much as you think they are.
Okay, so that's great. Sounds like some of my faculty members, but that's another story. Okay, thank you very much for that excellent presentation. Thank you. Congratulations again. And congratulations to all of the recipients. I was sitting in the audience, and there's a Yiddish word. I was felling, so there's like five people in here who understand what that means. I was just feeling extraordinarily pleased and proud that I am nominally in charge of an organization that can produce such a broad array of academic excellence on display in a single afternoon. I mean, that's just fantastic. So that's all for the official formal part. Thank you all for coming on this rainy day, and now you get to enjoy our refreshments and be in photos, and you can ask any other questions you want of our laureates individually. Have a great afternoon. Bye-bye.